TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Food and Genetic Engineering. Next time you're eating a corn chip that is not labeled organic, you may want to contemplate on the fact that you have a better than 30% chance of eating corn that is genetically engineered to contain Bacillus thuringiensis, or BT, a naturally occurring pesticide. Instead of spraying a pesticide on the plant that hopefully will have been washed off or evaporated by the time you eat the corn, you are now eating corn that contains a pesticide in all parts of the plant, leaves, stalk, and every cell and gene of the kernels. And while you're at it, you may want to look at the ingredient list on the back of the pack and may find soy there. Now you have a 60% chance that the soy you're eating is genetically engineered to tolerate large amounts of weed-killing chemicals, most commonly Monsanto's Roundup. Roundup-ready soy or corn, and maybe soon Roundup-ready wheat, are ironically sold to farmers as crops that need fewer chemicals. Why, then, are they engineered to tolerate larger amounts? Peter Rossett, co-director of Food First, has that claim on a long list of myths about engineered foods. He also talks about what health effects might be associated with eating engineered foods, what they do to insects, other plants, and soil, and why we sometimes see TV ads for a product with the appealing name of golden rice. Peter Rossett spoke at a workshop on food and genetic engineering in San Diego. He begins with a main argument by producers such as Monsanto or Aventis that there is a need for engineered food in order to feed the poor of the world. Here is Peter Rossett from Food First.
The first myth falls under the category of what I call industry poor washing. This is like whitewashing, but it's poor washing. This whole general set of arguments that we need genetically engineered food to feed the poor or the hungry in the third world. Basically, there's an underlying assumption, which is that people are hungry in the world today because there isn't enough food. Otherwise, they couldn't possibly be proposing food production technology to deal with it. And that's really difficult to understand, because if you take the total amount of food produced every day, available every day on the planet, and divide it by the number of women, men, and children on the planet, you'll find that the food per person has been growing much faster than population growth. We now have more food per person than ever before in human history. And that's why what we call hunger at Food First is the paradox of plenty. People are not hungry in today's world because there isn't enough food. They're hungry because of injustice, because of inequality, because too many people are too poor to have access to the abundance that's around them. As food becomes a commodity, only money will get you food, or land if you live in a rural area, and the same forces that exclude a lot of people from having money exclude a lot of people from having land. And that's the real cause of hunger, and no technological change in agriculture is going to address today's hunger. Another myth is that it's good for the environment, that these crops will reduce pesticide use. I call this greenwashing. Patently absurd. First of all, 80% of the crops that have been genetically engineered have been genetically engineered to tolerate herbicides. And what's really going on is a global battle for market share amongst herbicide companies. By acquiring seed companies and making those seeds basically work only with their particular brand of herbicides, they're fighting with each other over market share for herbicides. And you can be sure they would like to sell more herbicide rather than less herbicide. And there's significant evidence now that, on the whole, on the average, genetically engineered crops increase herbicide use. They don't decrease it. Another argument or myth or lie that they use is that genetic engineering offers the best solution for tough nutritional problems like vitamin A deficiency inducing blindness in areas in the third world. There are a lot of problems as to whether vitamin A or golden rice would actually get the farmers who have vitamin A deficiency in the first place. But even if it did, it shows an incredible naivete about whether vitamin A deficiency itself and the blindness it can cause is actually the problem or is the symptom of a deeper problem. And it turns out that wherever you see a single vitamin deficiency, like vitamin A deficiency, you also find deficiency of other vitamins, other micronutrients, and usually protein as well. The reason why people are deficient in vitamin A is because they're eating rice and nothing else, because they're too poor to buy a balanced diet, and because the Green Revolution, the idea of monocultures, came into those areas in the past and changed them from rural areas with a diversity of crops, including many green leafy vegetables and fruits and other things that supply vitamin A or beta carotene, were eliminated from the system. And a magic bullet solution to engineer one vitamin in there is not going to deal with the larger nutritional problem. It's an illusion. Another argument, of course, which has been alluded to, is that these products are safe for people and the environment. Just very quickly, the risks for human consumption have to do with allergens, have to do with potential new toxins, potential new carcinogens, have to do with the possibility of jumping genes, whether they could jump into our bodies or not. Now, these are some areas that are not well studied, but the possibilities exist. The possibilities of new diseases emerging because disease organisms could recombine with some of these genetic constructs and perhaps become more dangerous. In terms of dangers for the environment, there are the dangers associated with gene flow, pollinization. For example, insecticidal properties could move into wild relatives, into wild habitats, have dramatic effects on the food chain. Weeds could become tolerant to herbicides, become super weeds. The insecticidal crops, it turns out that those insecticidal properties persist in the soil after the crop stubble is plowed under for up to 256 days, and that's when they stop the study, so it may continue longer with effects on all kinds of soil microorganisms and arthropods that are critical for maintaining soil fertility. There's a very likely possibility shown by preliminary evidence that using the BT crops doesn't just affect the insecticidal crops, doesn't just affect the crop pests, but also the natural enemies that would normally exert some natural population control on those pests. So there's a possibility of disrupting a lot of regulatory mechanisms in the ecosystem. There's the myth also alluded to that these products have been well tested, so we don't need to worry about it. Well, it turns out that in the United States, for example, the Food and Drug Administration has required zero mandatory safety tests. Zero. There are many voluntary tests. Now, the history of companies like Monsanto, who've brought us Agent Orange and a very large percentage of the Superfund toxic waste dumps, in terms of are expecting them to voluntarily do all of the testing, and then if they find anything questionable, to voluntarily come forward and bring it to the Food and Drug Administration as a regulatory process. Frankly, that's quite laughable. And the reality is that all three of the important regulatory agencies in the U.S. with oversight over genetically engineered crops, and that's the FDA, the EPA, and the USDA, have essentially been asleep at the wheel. And of course, that sleep has been induced by that wonderful sleeping drug called money and politics. The final myth is that genetic engineering is the same as conventional plant breeding. In some sense, this is a continuum of technological advances in terms of genetic manipulation. But at the same time as it's a continuum where genetic engineering follows logically after the Green Revolution, follows logically upon hybrid crops, follows logically upon mechanization and agrochemicals and chemical fertilizers, in another sense, it is a leap that hasn't been made before, and that is crossing the species barrier and taking individual isolated genes from one organism, from one genetic background, if you will, and placing them into another genetic background or genetic environment in which they've never been found before. And if folks remember anything back to your high school biology or college biology, you will probably remember that the expression of a gene in a phenotype has a lot to do with the environment in which that gene is expressing itself. not just the environment outside the organism, if you're living in the Arctic or in the desert or in the tropics or on a mountain or in the ocean, but also the environment inside the cell. And in fact, genes on our chromosomes have very important interactions amongst them. We have genes called modifier genes, which modify the way other genes behave, suppressor genes, which suppress the behavior of certain genes, promoter genes, which promote the behavior of other genes, regulatory genes, which regulate the behavior of other genes. All of these evolve together in what are called co-evolved gene complexes when they remain in the original organism that nature intended them to remain in. When a gene is taken from one organism and put into another, it doesn't bring with it its regulators and modifiers, suppressors and promoters that make sure it behaves well and doesn't do something really whacked out like producing some substance that in a small amount is good for you and a large amount is bad for you. There are lots of substances like that. A gene without its regulatory genes might suddenly go whacked out and produce 400 or 4,000 times more of some substance. And you really don't know when it's in a new genetic background.
That was Peter Rossett, co-director of Food First. Next up are Brewster and Kathleen Neen, former sheep ranchers from Nova Scotia. Brewster Neen is the author of the aptly named book Farmageddon, Food and the Culture of Biotechnology. While Brewster is intrigued by the thought, what kind of culture can lead to the practice of engineering plants and even us humans? His wife, Kathleen, talks about the communal culture of eating. Here is Brewster Neen.
We have a big problem on our hands. I mean, that's why you're here. But I want to stress the we, because I think that biotechnology, genetic engineering, is a product or the creation of the culture that we inhabit and express and live amongst and we're raised in. But it's not only a problem that we have created, it's a problem that we have imposed on the rest of the world. We have, you know, a long record of imperialism, and I think it's not unfair to describe genetic engineering as the latest and probably the most sophisticated and most pernicious wave of imperialism that we are trying to push around the world. And in a sense, in that is also the imposition of our agenda. And I think right now it's being expressed very distastefully by Monsanto on the issue of transgenic wheat, particularly in Canada, but also in the northern prairie states, where Monsanto is insisting that it is going to go ahead with this Roundup Ready wheat, regardless of whether anybody in the world wants it or not, including the Canadian Wheat Board, the farmers, the retailers, the grains companies, or anybody else. Basically, Monsanto, someone saying from Monsanto, well, this is our agenda. The Wheat Board, the Canadian Wheat Board, will simply have to figure out how to deal with it. And it's quite striking that you have Monsanto not only being the creator of the stuff, but also kind of now moving into the role of a political dictator. And it's really appalling. But this is a cultural phenomenon we're dealing with, so I put it that way. Hopefully, Monsanto, as it has done on previous occasions, will succeed in uniting sufficient opposition to bring a halt to its madness. What we are witnessing is now becoming obvious, namely the deliberate contamination or pollution of our food system with genetically modified crops, to the point of where they're saying, too bad, you can't do anything about it. Aventis, Monsanto, they all knew perfectly well what they're doing in terms of deliberately trying to push this stuff out with the compliance and support of the Food and Drug Administration here and the Canadian Food Inspection Agency in Canada to get this out without labeling before the public woke up to what had happened and say, too bad, folks, too late. Well, I guess we all are here because we don't think it is too late, but we've got to do something about it. So biotechnology, as the word itself indicates, is the application of technology to life. Even more, it is life itself regarded as a technology, a matter of Lego, selecting and constructing life at will. Biotechnology is practically, then, the deliberate manipulation and alteration of genetic materials without respect for natural boundaries or the integrity of the organism at whatever level or stage. And that's where I like to think of it in terms of the whole range from WTO down to the genome or the cell, in that it's really the same restructuring of life at every level for corporate profit. To my mind, biotechnology, genetic engineering, is essentially a death industry. It is much more interested, as the picture of the monocrop corn, that for the survival of the elite, there is a willingness to kill virtually everything else that gets in the way. To achieve that monoculture corn, how many organisms have had to be killed, eliminated, cleansed from the system, above ground and below? Because what you end up with in this is a crop which has no home. It has no natural environment. It is utterly dependent on crop protection agents, which is what you refer to agrotoxins now. It without the sprayer, without the irrigation, without the fertilizers and the pesticides, it would not be there. If you do a head count of organisms along the way, there are very few survivors and a great many victims. But I think the repositioning of the life industries from food to human health is to shift from what is a more collective point of view to appealing for individual benefits for those who can afford a very small fraction of the world and the very tip of it, with the rest of the world paying for those benefits for that wealthy elite.
That was Bruce Dineen, author of Farmageddon and From Land to Mouth. He and his wife raised sheep for 15 years in Nova Scotia and now publish a monthly newsletter on food systems called The Ram's Horn. And in a recent development, in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, it was announced on January 10, 2002, that organic farmers are suing Monsanto and Aventis for damages caused by their genetically engineered canola, and to get an injunction to prevent Monsanto from introducing genetically engineered wheat in Saskatchewan. They claim that genetically engineered canola has spread across Canada and contaminated organic crops so extensively that most certified organic grain farmers no longer even attempt to grow canola. The same would happen if they released genetically engineered wheat, as they are still planning to do next year. And here now, after this news bulletin, is Kathleen Neen.
Somehow or other, we've managed to separate food and farming. When we think about food, we don't initially think about the people who are producing the food, whether they're farmers or fisher folk. And by the same token, farmers don't think what they're producing is food. What they're producing is edible commodities for the market. So we've gotten ourselves stuck. And I do want to talk about food. I want to talk about food because, for me, eating is an intensely personal business. It's a very intimate act. You're taking something into your mouth, which becomes your body. I mean, think about it. And what Brewster was just referring to in terms of the attempt by the biotech industry to take control of all the crops and, by extension, of all the foods that we eat, means that they are also attempting to control us in our most intimate personal selves, which is the point where I start getting riled up about it. Food is the basis of personal health. It's the basis of culture. It's the basis of community. And we have somehow been led to believe that food can be deconstructed into its component bits. And if there's a bit missing, why, you can go and purchase a pill or a supplement which will provide you with the nutrients that you need. I think that particularly women who are responsible for the health of their families find themselves asking questions now about the kind of food that we're getting. The idea that food is made up of nutritional elements that can be replaced by synthetic chemicals is the same in the same order of things that assumes that a scrap of DNA, if you take it out of one organism and put it into another organism, will do exactly the same thing over here that it did over there. And it's equally nuts, because we know, you know, we as people know, that it's different depending on the context. And who our food is, what our food does to us, is different depending on the context. The major issue that has come up around genetically engineered food, the main thing I think that has actually horrified people is not so much this reductionist idea, but the fact that we're not told. The fact that genetically engineered foods are not labeled is, again, no accident. And aside from the kind of Machiavellian politics that Brewster was talking about, the attempt to contaminate the entire food system, it's also important to recognize that what has been genetically engineered are the major industrial crops. So the foods that we eat these days are not the kind of foods that our great-grandparents ate. Our great-grandparents ate what are now called whole foods. They ate foods which we now have to pay a high price for in the whole food store. What we eat are manufactured edible commodities made up of, and very often, half a dozen crops. So if you go into the supermarket, you'll see 20 or 30,000 different items. But within those items, there's half a dozen major crops. Corn, canola, cotton, soy, potatoes. These are the major crops which have been engineered, because that's where the money is. Every one of us is an expert on what our own bodies need to eat. But we have also been bamboozled into thinking that that means that somehow or other we can individually defend ourselves on an individual basis against this gigantic food industry by eating one way or another, by becoming vegetarian, by eating organic food. And to a certain extent, this is perfectly true. There are some things that we can do on an individual basis, for sure. We can read the labels and we can understand. But just as mad cow disease and the recent hoof and mouth disease was not so much, I think, a health scare as it was a wake-up call to the way in which the food system has been industrialized. So I think while we need to defend ourselves on a personal basis, for sure, I think to assume that what we need to do about the genetic engineering of food is to change what we personally eat is to take only the first step down a road which in fact goes in somewhat of a different direction. What's important, I think, is to recognize what it is that the food industry has done to us. Essentially, the food industry has attempted to turn us into a nation of addicts, starting with breast milk substitutes and going all the way down the line to Ensure. We are, I think, deliberately being addicted to sugar, fat, and salt. In other words, the basic components of industrial foodstuffs. And I think it's important to think this way because it takes away, in some senses, the feeling of guilt. When you recognize that what you're dealing with is not simply a personal failing to identify what is good food, but the fact that you've been deliberately put into a situation where you have been deliberately removed from a certain level of power, I think, first of all, it's going to make you angry. It makes me angry. And it's also going to suggest that perhaps there are 12 steps out of this. And the first step is recognizing the reality. And the second step is recognizing that you can't get there alone. As I said before, everything has its context. And while eating is intensely personal, the context of eating is intensely social. So if we are going to deal with the problems of genetic engineering of our food supply, then yes, we have to change what we eat, for sure. And I will be the first person to say that you need to start eating organic foods and staying away from things which we know contain genetically engineered organisms. Because they're not labeled and we don't know, because they're not tested, because what we have is not a regulatory process, but an approval process. Just think about the difference between those two words. So, to go back, yes, we have to avoid genetically engineered food on a personal basis. But that is not going to, I don't think, stop genetic engineering and genetic tinkering in the food supply. Any more than refusing to eat meat is going to stop the factory farming of meat. It may have a dent on it, but what it's not going to do is to make sure that the grain which was being fed to those factory farmed animals is going to the hungry of the world. In other words, the structure of the system will not be, I think, significantly changed by our individual personal decisions to eat a more healthy diet. However, just the fact that we're on the Titanic doesn't mean that we shouldn't be constructing lifeboats. And I believe that the system is, in fact, doomed to sink. I hope I'm not around when it happens, because I think it's going to be very, very messy. But what I think we need to be about is constructing lifeboats and making sure that we know where the rowlocks are and making sure that we know where the oars are and that they're all in place. And what I mean by that is that we need to be looking at the various components of a different kind of food system. A food system which is not dependent on transnational corporations for feeding us. A food system which is not linear, but circular. A food system in which, in fact, most of the food you eat is produced by somebody whose face you recognize.
That was Kathleen Neen, co-publisher of the magazine The Ram's Horn. Kathleen and Brewster Neen spoke, along with Peter Rossett from Food First, on genetically engineered food. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on food and genetic engineering on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get a copy of the full one-hour program, Food and Genetic Engineering. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.